All right, we are ready to start. We're in Numbers 12, so if you want to open up to Numbers. We've been going through, just walking through the Bible narrative. So we've got before the flood, scattering the people, patriarchs, Exodus. And today we're going to transition from Exodus to wandering in the wilderness. We talk about periods of Bible history that should not have happened. And you might just say that all of them in some way should not have happened except for before the flood. But when sin entered the world through Adam and Eve, then things changed. Not unanticipated by God. God knew it was coming and he planned for it in his wisdom and his grace. So this is a part of that story where God knew this was going to happen and he's going to be teaching us things all through the story. Let's go ahead and start with prayer. And Justin, would you mind praying for us?
Sure. Dear Heavenly Father, we're so thankful for another wonderful day that you've given to us. We're thankful for everybody that's here, and we look forward to our study this morning. Help us to all be encouraged, all be participants, and all be active listeners. Help us to rid our mind of outside distractions and focus on what we're talking about this morning. Help us to recall what we've studied in recent weeks and months in Numbers and previous books of the Bible as well, so that we can continue to understand the whole message here and continue to improve our understanding. We're again so thankful that we could all come together to study your word, and it's in your son's name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. All right, so some relevant stories from Numbers. We've done some overview. Justin was praying that we would see these things in our lives. So what have you noticed so far in the book of Numbers that's significant or important to you, things that you think are applicable to you? So far, so good. Okay, Lynn?
Well, I'm just thinking about the last lesson where they were craving meat and they were talking about all the good things in Egypt that they missed. And so I just think about how it's really easy to have selective memory, and it's easy to amplify things that might have been a good part, but then completely diminish the hard or the bad, and then lose sight of who God was in all of that and taking care of that portion.
Yeah, when we're tempted by sin, I think it's pretty rare that we're actually tempted by things that are evil. Now, let me see if I can say that a different way. It's not that we go, ooh, that's evil, let me go do that thing, right? It's the temptation that says, your heart wants this, this is a good thing, but the temptation is, but this is the bad way to get it, this is the twisted, perverted way to get it. And so the people are wanting sustenance, they're wanting joy and blessedness, and God intends to give that to them in the promised land his way, but they're thinking about going back to Egypt and leaving God behind in order to get it. So when we leave God behind in order to get the things that we want, that's idolatry, that's sin. You know, we've turned away from God, we've missed pleasing him. So the book of Numbers in the wilderness shows us that kind of conflict, that kind of tension that the Israelites are feeling. Sometimes they're legitimate wants, things that God wants to give us, but we're pushing him away so that we can get that thing. It's more important to us than God is, which is why it's idolatry. What else? What else has stood out to you? It doesn't have to be that, that's a big thing. It can be something small. What else? We'll start calling on people. All right.
Getting bogged down by things that are unpleasant and, not seeing the bigger picture.
Right, right. We're hungry, we're thirsty, you brought us out here to die, and just on and on and on again. And Numbers is just full, if I could rename the book of Numbers, it'd be called just complaining, or grumbling, or something like that. But it's just full of that kind of attitude, and instead of seeing the joy of the Lord, and where they were, measuring to where they're going, yeah, we get bogged down in these little things that kind of grind at us, okay? Anything else? Anything else that just stands out to you? I'll say one thing that's been impressive to me is the focus on the camp structure. You think, well, how is that applicable? What was the focus of the camp organization, all of that? God's in the center. Everything's focused on God, keeping God in your midst. What a blessing if that is. God had been planning this from the garden, right? And so God's going to be dwelling in their midst. He's going to be traveling with them. What a humble and gracious God to say, I'm going with you, not just I'm sending you. He was going to do that. And Moses said, no, please go with us. So God does go in their midst. We want God to be with us. And so it means thinking about him, focusing on him, the purity and holiness and the sacrifice that demands. And of course, we have that through Christ. So what a joy that God is with us. All right? Now, we're in Numbers 12, and this is kind of an interesting section. If you have questions or objections even, or like, I don't, help me understand this, you want to talk about something as we read today, please do. Like, raise your hand, don't be afraid, because there are some things that I think we're going to read today that we'll go, wait a minute, that's not fair. Let's talk about it, okay? I'm not going to have all the answers, okay, Katie? But, you know, let's talk about it. Let's bring it up. So, Numbers chapter 12, verses 1 through 9. Get a volunteer to read that. Lynn, you looked up. Go ahead, verses 1 through 9.
Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. For he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all the people who were on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tent of meeting. And the three of them came out. And the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And he said, hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, and not in riddles. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed.
All right, so Moses is having this conflict with his brother and sister. A lot of interesting things about this. You talk about birth order. You could talk about male-female relationships. I mean, you could talk about all sorts of things here. But what seems to be Miriam and Aaron's complaint?
He's the only prophet guy among us.
Okay. Yeah, I like that you said that. Are you the only prophet amongst us? Now, that by itself doesn't sound like a complaint. That just sounds like a question. See if you can reword it as a complaint. Lynn?
Well, I'm trying to understand because it says that they spoke against him because of who he married, but what they questioned him about has nothing to do with who he married necessarily.
Okay.
But somehow it's linked.
Are you ever upset with somebody about something, but then you talk to them as though it's really about something else? No, of course not. I mean, and sometimes we don't even know it, right? Like, something has set us off and we're upset, and then we don't realize that actually there's this whole pile of complaints that's come up, and then it's just the last straw. And we don't take the time to process that or think about that, or we're actually a little dishonest, and we try to make it about some legitimate thing when really we're upset about some illegitimate thing. Okay? I think that's kind of what Aaron and Miriam are doing here. But talk again about the complaint. How would you reword the complaint? Because God doesn't talk about the Cushite woman. Okay? We'll talk about the Cushite woman in just a second. He talks about their complaint. Can you reword their question? Because what they say is, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? What's the answer to that? No. When did God speak through Aaron? Remember going to Pharaoh? He says, doesn't your Aaron, your brother, doesn't he speak well? A lot of times Moses was speaking through Aaron. God was speaking through Moses, through Aaron, to Pharaoh. So God spoke through Aaron. Did God ever speak through Miriam? Okay, all right, that was a dumb question. When did God speak through Miriam?
When they came through the Red Sea.
Yeah, the Red Sea, yeah. The Red Sea. Exodus 15, right, the song, and she is helping to lead the women in worshiping God and praising God. So God's speaking through Aaron and Miriam. So the answer to that question is, well, no. Has he not spoken through us also? Yes. And the Lord heard it. And he says, all right, you three, gather in the living room, on the couch. That's kind of what we would say. But he's like, for the tent of meeting, let's talk. So how would, like, this seems like just a very simple, fair question. But it upsets God because he hears the complaint. How would you word this as a complaint?
You want to be important too.
You're getting there. We want to be important too. Is that a complaint? See if you can. That sounds like that's just a statement of fact. See if you can word it as a complaint. Say, I'm not
getting enough glory.
I'm not being treated like I deserve. I'm not being adequately esteemed. That's the complaint, you see? So God hears that, and that's what makes him angry. Now let's go back to the Cushite woman for a second. Why is this here? Like, we never meet this Cushite woman. There's no story about her. Last we heard, Moses is married to who?
Zipporah.
We meet her in Exodus 2. She shows up again in Exodus 4 when Moses is going back to Egypt. She helps Moses, intercedes, actually, between Moses and God. God's angry with him about the circumcision of his son. At some point, we're not told when, Moses seems to send Zipporah away back to Midian. It seems like during the plagues, and if I can put myself in Moses' shoes for a second, I could imagine things are getting so bad during the plagues, he says, Zipporah, go back home, take my children, and I'll meet up with you when God delivers Israel. Because then we find out that Jethro brings her and his sons, Gershom and Eliezer? No, not Merari. Let me see, it's Exodus 18, right? Exodus 18... Gershom and Eliezer, yeah, okay. I was confused because Aaron has a son named Eliezer. This is Eliezer. There you go. And so he brings them out to meet Moses. So we see Zipporah, and all of a sudden, there's a Cushite woman. What would this do to a Hebrew picture of Moses to know that he's married to first a Midianite woman and now a Cushite woman? And for this whole drama about not approving of his wife. What does this do to their picture of their prophet? If you're a Hebrew, who is Moses? You put words to the gesture? I like the gesture. Well, how would you say that?
He's like the liaison between the people and God.
He is the mediator. Right? Like, he's the one who brought the whole covenant. Like, he's the one who delivered. So you're thinking Moses is the guy, but he married a Cushite woman. So what does that change about this? And here's another question. Why does he marry a Cushite woman? Are there not Israelite women? Surely there are Hebrew women who would be available for Moses to marry. But here's a Cushite woman. What does that change about your view about the nation of Israel? I don't have answers to those questions, but it seems to me this is an important detail for future generations of Jews to think about, because the focus isn't on a national Israel. It turns out that Israel, in these little details, is being shown not to be just a national, genetically bloodline-focused people. It's really about a people who chose to come out of Egypt to follow God. Why did this Cushite woman leave Egypt? Well, she left slavery, we'd say. Yeah, but she goes with the Israelite people. And Moses found something in her. So it's interesting to see this whole connection. The focus isn't on a nationality. The focus is on what she thinks about God. Now, that's an important detail of this whole story. She's focused on God, her relationship with God. Moses is focused on God. And what are Aaron and Miriam focused on? I'm not getting the glory. I'm not being treated like I deserve. And God says, excuse me, and has them come out. Now, how does God deal with this? How does he approach their whole complaint? Miriam and Aaron. I have indeed spoken to prophets, right? How does he speak to most prophets?
Riddles.
Yep. Well, riddles he talks about. And they're not clear, right? And with Moses, he speaks with him mouth to mouth, or face to face, we'd say. Now, here's a little detail here that's thrown in here, and we can maybe laugh about this if you want to. But verse 3, the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth. We understand that who wrote the book of Numbers? I think it's okay to say, like, Moses wrote this, right? Maybe Moses didn't write this sentence, I don't know. But it's just kind of funny, like, you know, in my prayer journal, you know, and Justin was so very meek. He was just more meek than anybody else. But he's got a case to make, and I want to talk about this. What does it mean to be meek?
Gentleness.
Think of being gentle, okay? So like Sloane. Is Sloane gentle? I mean, she's she's an infant, what damage can she do? But is she the definition of meekness? I would say no. I'm not sure you consider something. Here's power. And if you are, let's not use Sloan, let's use Peyton, okay? That's not quite. Peyton, you know, Sloan's big sister. And you need to open a jar of mayonnaise. I have no idea why she would want to open a jar of mayonnaise, but she wants Nutella or whatever. She's got to open this thing. How much power does that take for her to open that jar? All of her power. All of her power. Now, let's say you're, I don't know, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. And you use all of your power to open the Nutella jar. What happens to the Nutella jar? Nutella goes everywhere, right? Okay. Meekness is the ability to use self-control as you exert your power. In other words, meekness is power under control. The more power you have, the more self-control you need. And so as you grow in power, you know, boys and girls who grow up, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, suddenly I have the image of a colt with legs too long, right? And so, like, their body is changing, they're getting strength, and they can't play with their little siblings the way they used to, because what are they going to do? Hurt them, or even, like, hug mommy the way they used to, because they're going to hurt her. Like, so you get, as you grow in strength, you have to learn control. So the more power you have, meekness means more self-control. Now, people in the world, they say, if you have power, what should you do with it? You should use it. For who? For yourself. In fact, the world wants you to tell yourself, I am powerful, I am strong, I am glorious. And what? No, God is powerful, God is strong, God is glorious. And who knew that more than anyone? At this point, Moses. Moses had seen God, seen his glory on Mount Sinai. I mean, he'd been with him like from burning bush, right? And so he has had some view of power. And who is God using to deliver the people and to mediate the covenant? You see the point we're making. I think Moses saying he's more meek is really him saying, I have access to more power than anyone, and I've got to practice self-control in order to show it. Here's a passage to think about, and you might write this in your Bible if you take notes in your margins. Proverbs 16:32, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. You got a walled city. It takes power to take that city. You know it takes more power? The self-control to tell yourself no. It's harder to tell yourself no than it is to conquer a whole city. And so as you think about meekness, think about the one who said that I have the power to call down 12 legions of angels and told himself no. If Moses is meek, then how much more is Jesus meek? Okay. That's just a little side point, I think about meekness. Important because Jesus says, what about those who are meek? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The world says, if you're powerful, then take it. The gospel is that power should be put under control, under the will of God, and he will give you the earth. He will give you his kingdom. Right? Thoughts, questions about meekness? That's a little sidetrack. Come back, talk about Moses and Zipporah. God's pretty upset, and he says, I speak with most prophets through these visions, dreams. He calls them riddles, in a sense, things that aren't quite clear sometimes. Like, for example, Abraham split the animals apart. He falls asleep and has this vision in his dream in the night of this smoking pot and the torch coming down through the animals. Well, what does that mean? You know, and Abraham's got, I don't know, like, and so we can look back and see some meaning with this, but in the moment it's like, I don't know. Remember, Pharaoh has the two dreams. Skinny cow, he's the big fat cow. He wakes up in cold sweat. No idea what this means. Joseph has got to explain the thing, right? And so we're looking at this, things aren't quite clear. Does God do the same thing with Moses? No. He speaks with Moses face to face, mouth to mouth. And he beholds the form of the Lord. And he's faithful in all God's house. Question, where is God's house in this moment, at this time? Numbers 12.
Tabernacle.
The tabernacle? Is that what he's referring to as God's house? The house is meaning like the household, the family, right? Moses is serving God's family. He's serving the house of God, the household of God. And so he's faithful in that way. Now you can make the connection to the tabernacle, but there's always going to be this connection between God dwelling with his people, right? And the tabernacle and his people. That's the whole connection. Now, do you see where I'm going with this? You might have caught on. There are two panels here. What's the third panel going to be? Anybody want to guess?
It's going to be Jesus.
Because what about Jesus? Well, you can look at John 1. You can look at Hebrews. In John 1, Jesus is not speaking with God mouth to mouth. He is God's mouth. He is the Word of God. And he was from the beginning. And Moses gets to glimpse something of the glory of God at Mount Sinai. Jesus is the exact imprint of his nature in Hebrews 1, first three verses. And Hebrews emphasizes that Moses is a servant in the house, and he's also kind of the house itself. He's part of the family. But Jesus is the builder of the house, and he's not a servant. He's the son. He's the heir of the house. Don't want to leave this passage without seeing that point. Now, none of that's really focused of 1 through 9, but I hope that's helpful in thinking about where this goes in the story. Moses is exalted here before Miriam and Aaron, and God is angry when they don't appreciate Moses' role. How much more is God angry when we don't appreciate Jesus' role? Okay, you see that? All right. So God's upset with them. We've not read the conclusion to this whole argument. Elijah, you're looking at me. Go ahead and read 10 through 16. So God descends in the cloud, has this declaration to Miriam and Aaron about Moses, sets the record straight between the three. The cloud is removed in verse 10. And the result? I'm sorry?
Poor Miriam.
Poor Miriam. Yeah, that's a response, right? Is that what God felt? But we do say poor Miriam. Why do we say poor Miriam? She's leprous. Questions?
Leprous and isolated, too.
Okay, she used to be put outside the camp. How long is she going to be put outside the camp? And that connects back with Leviticus 14, where we saw the rules about this. When someone's cleansed of leprosy, there's to be a period of... So they're healed from leprosy, then there's a period of spiritual cleansing for the 7 days. So God is promising a restoration, but she's still to be removed for those 7 days. Other questions? I'm waiting for the question.
Why Miriam?
Thank you.
Why not Aaron?
And why not Aaron? That's not fair.
The high priest.
Okay, so Aaron's got a job to do, doesn't he? And if Miriam is to be cleansed, then what is Aaron going to have to be doing? You see, he's got a job in this situation. And what God's doing is he's putting him back in his role. He's getting to... big for his britches, you might say. He's getting ahead of himself. And so God is actually putting him back in his role as a mediator, not exalting himself, but serving someone else. And Miriam, both of them are put to shame in this way. But Miriam is the one who's going to get the brunt of this, and she's going to be restored. I still have questions about this, as I see some of you may still have. I don't know. Thoughts, questions, observations? How do you make sense of this? Alex?
In verse 14, it talks about how if her father had spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Is her getting leprosy kind of like God spitting in her face?
That's a good question. I don't want to say no, because God talks about that. And I don't think here God is condoning a father spitting in his daughter's face. But I think he's saying that she behaved in a way that deserved this kind of response. She behaved in a shameful way, and so she's being shamed. I think that's what God's saying here. Grace? Excellent observation, yeah. Miriam, her personality may be something she has to overcome. Just because you have a personality, an assertive personality, doesn't mean that you always should lead in these ways. And I think you're right. Aaron with the golden calf, right? Is that what you're thinking? It's a good observation. Lynn?
Is it a stretch to look at this and say that when God looks at the heart, I'm thinking of parenting specifically, like when you're trying to discern the heart and you're trying to guide the heart, then it's not cookie cutter. And it's easy to want it to be cookie cutter because that's just easier sometimes. But here we have an instance where there are two people who participated in the same thing, but God knows what's going to turn their heart. And so he has something that it's going to be hard for both of them. And I think about the shame that Aaron would feel because he's sitting there going, well, my sister's struck leprous. What a shame on me that what we did, now my sister's bearing the brunt of this. But then also, in order for her to be cleansed, he's going to have to do the cleansing with her. Like, there's a purification process that he's going to have to be a part of with her.
Yeah.
So I just think about, it's easy to want cookie cutter, but God's not a cookie cutter God. And so trying to look at the heart and discern the heart and help the heart.
I think it's helpful. In some ways it's helpful, in some other ways it's challenging, right? Because it's easy to say, here are the rules. I take the rules God's given me. I take the child, and they broke the rules. What's the thing I do? And I apply that. But there's something more challenging about seeing the heart of the child. And when there are multiple children, you just want to go, and there you all get the same thing. But you've got to understand your children. And we see God do that, where you know, Uzzah touches the ark, and he's killed. David sleeps with a woman that's not his wife, and he lives. And God is discerning all that. So we do see a God who's patient and compassionate, but just, and wants to teach them how to respond to him in a holy way. So I think as parents, or maybe not just as parents, but as brothers and sisters helping each other. 1 Thessalonians 5 comes to mind, right? The weak, the idle. We've got to be thoughtful about each other and be looking to see what was intended, but also what should be the action, the behavior that we're doing. It's not just the heart that matters. It is the behavior. But there's some compassion we need to practice in looking at that.
Well, and just to point out in verse 11, this idea that Aaron is feeling this punishment because he says, don't punish us.
Yeah, look at his words here. Do not punish us. We have done foolishly and have sinned. Did God get a confession out of Aaron? Yeah, he got the result that he wanted. Let her not be as one dead. And Moses responds, please, please. And God responds in a favorable way. Maybe not as favorable as Moses wanted, but it was still actually the blessing that they needed, even if it wasn't the response they wanted. All right, we better keep cooking here. Other thoughts through chapter 12? Grace, Emma.
I have a handwritten note in my Bible, which I'm not exactly sure about, but I have that the spoke in verse 1 in Hebrew is a girl.
Ooh.
So, I haven't done the research, but...
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I
don't know. The English says Miriam and Aaron, but I'd have to look at that. That would connect really well with Grace's point. Both are punished. I think it's important to see both are punished. Aaron does have a role as high priest. I'd have to look at that. It's good. Don't you love it when you find notes and you're like, who wrote that? I mean, I know I wrote that, but I don't. All right, let's look at chapter 13, okay? We're not going to read all of chapter 13, but the men who are listed as going into the land. Now, I have this as Numbers 13 and Deuteronomy 1. We won't take the time to look at Deuteronomy 1, but if you can make a note of that and you want to look at that later. Here it says that the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 2, send men to spy out the land of Canaan. It's important to note that in Deuteronomy 1, this is the idea of the people. The people say, we'd like to know about the land. We want to know what this land is that we're going into. So let's send some people up to spy it out. And they ask permission of God, and God says yes. So God is the final authority here, and he does send the spies to go up and see the land. But it was something of the people that said, We'd really like to know more about where God's taking us here, which I think is interesting. If you had a filing cabinet that had sorted out drawer by drawer, file by file, all the things that were going to happen to you in the years and months and days ahead. Good things and bad things. The day your mother dies. The day you get married. The day you have a child. The day that you lose your job. I mean, it has everything listed in it. Would you want access to that filing cabinet? I wouldn't. I would live in terror knowing what was there, even just knowing about it. I think there are good things about just trusting God for the journey. Some of you are like, I want access to that thing. God allows them access to see the future, and what do they do with it? They balk at following God. So there's something about just trusting God for the journey here. Now, it mentions the 12 spies by name. I have them listed here just to have them pointed out. Who do you remember from this list? 12 spies.
Joshua and Caleb.
By the way, Hoshea is named Joshua here in verse 16. Moses called Hoshea Joshua. These are the two guys that we remember. So why do we even need these other names? Thoughts?
I mean, it would
be
good to, wouldn't it be fun to have your name in the Bible as
what are you going to be remembered for? They're not going to be. They're going to be remembered for disbelief and for rebellion and for leading the people into sin. Now, none of us want to be remembered for that. But the only way to get remembered for good things is to be busy doing good things. To be remembered for faithfulness is to be faithful. To be joyful and hopeful and helping to encourage other people. So Caleb and Joshua get remembered because they were the guys who did the right thing. These other guys, you say, well, we don't remember them. Yeah, but they're listed there. So be thoughtful about it. So they go into the land, and what do they find? It's called a land flowing with milk and honey, is it? I mean, not literally, I suppose, but like it is, you know, a figurative picture, right? I don't think it's ice cream sundaes going down the slopes of, you know, Mount Zion. Anyway, but it's a beautiful land, and they bring back proof. They've got this cluster of grapes. It's a season for ripe grapes, since they bring back this. And it's just exciting how prosperous and beautiful this land is. But what else do they find? And so they find these giants. They are the descendants of the Nephilim, the Anakim. And so there's some big people up there. All right. And so they get back. How long do they spend in the land? 40 days. Usually if there's a question about how long, 40 is a good guess. You know, 40 days. And they come back with this report. It's a good land, but we can't go in there. God has brought us up here to die. We can't overcome the people. We're like grasshoppers in their eyes. Verse 29, the Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites. All of these nations God knew about. He knew where he was leading them. But these are fortified cities. They're very large. They're strong. We can't go in. Meanwhile, Caleb tries to quiet the people, and he says, let us go up at once, in verse 30, we are well able to overcome it. Caleb is excited about going up. He thinks this is an opportunity to test the power of God, not is it really there, but to prove it. He wants to show that God is great, God is with them, he'll be with us to take care of us, but the people still say, we can't. And so we got these two voices going on in the camp. Elijah?
So with the verse 23, it talks about carrying a cluster of grapes on between two of them. Is that like an abnormal size for grapes, or is that just... That's what I think of grapes. I usually think of a little plastic box.
You know, I don't think I have a good grasp. Anybody expert in grapeology here? I will submit to your knowledge. I picture this two men that have to carry it on their shoulders because, I mean, it's just hanging down, these cluster of grapes. Usually when grapes grow on the vine, I don't think they get... I mean, this would be a big cluster. right? At least what I see in vineyards driving by on the side of the road. So something that has to be hung along a rod so it won't drag the ground as they're walking back, that's pretty good stuff. I'm out of my depth there. Okay, so these two voices are in the camp, and what do the people do? What's the word that we keep coming back to? You can use any form of the word. They complain, they grumble, they moan, they groan. And so they spend all night in their tents weeping and raising a loud cry. Verse 2, they're grumbling. So they cry themselves to sleep all night. And they say in verse 2, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives, our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt? And they said to one another, let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt. They can't stay in the wilderness. And I can't stress that enough. Like there's no way they can stay in the wilderness. The only reason that they're able to survive in the wilderness is because God is miraculously providing bread and water. So they can't stay in this in-between space. And sometimes we think we can. So it's either go back to the master in Egypt or go forward with the master of God. God's surely going to kill them if they follow him. So it's better to go back and serve and be slaves, but still live. That's what they're thinking. Thoughts, Lynn?
I'm just thinking about, in this whole description that these spies bring back, there's no viewpoint of God in it. It's all about the people and us. And we're just making this people comparison. And even when they come in chapter 14 and the people grumble, they grumble against Moses and Aaron. They don't even include God in it. The only mention that they make to God is in verse 3, where they ascribe to him, he brought us out of the land to die by the sword. Like, they just, they're only ready to apply something bad to him, and everything else is just earth-focused.
If you were Caleb, if you're Joshua, or if you're just, I don't know, standing in the crowd and you're trying to convince them to go in, what would you say at this point? How would you try to encourage them, let's go into the land, let's take it, let's follow God? Nicole?
Do you remember Egypt? Do you remember how God overcame that army?
Yeah. And just like tell the story again. How long had it been? Just over a year. And how quickly we forget. I mean, it's a long story. Get into the details. Like make it vibrant. Make it real. The reason that we get stressed, the reason that we get anxious, the reason we worry and we fail to be faithful is because we've just forgotten the story. And it's, I think just retelling the story, remembering who they were, where they'd come from, had to be encouraging. I don't know what they're thinking about those miracles, but that part of the story is very, it's like a footnote in their mind right now. It's everything that's going ahead of us, and we forget where God has led us before. What else might you say? I think there's something else that they could talk about here. What else? Mike?
Who has allowed you to survive in the wilderness for this long?
Yeah, yeah. Did you eat breakfast this morning? Are you going to eat breakfast tomorrow? I mean, just talking through the reality of the day-to-day and remembering that God was with him. I would also think, talking about the covenant. You know, God has promised to be with us. What kind of God is he? You know, what did we see at the mountain? We were terrified. Don't you think if he's with us, the people will be terrified too? Let's go. But the people, they're complaining again. They're deciding to go back. Joshua and Caleb end up tearing their clothes. Moses and Aaron fall down on their faces before God, and they're trying to convince them, but then finally they're going to stone Moses, Aaron, Joshua, and Caleb. And as they pick up stones to throw them, the glory of the Lord appears in the tent, and God says he's going to destroy all the people. read verse 11 and 12. The Lord said to Moses, how long will this people despise me? How long will they not believe in me in spite of all the signs that I have done among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. I'll suggest to you that if God had done that, it still would have been in keeping with the promises he made Abraham back in Genesis 12. I think he could have done that and still made good on his promise. But Moses intercedes. Verse 13 through 19, he intercedes in a few ways. First of all, he appeals to God on the basis of God's might. And it's a concern for the glory of God's might. Moses is going to go to God and say, please don't destroy these people. Because if you destroy these people now, then everyone who's heard about you delivering Israel from Egypt, they're going to think that you just weren't strong enough to take them the whole way. And I don't want anybody to think about the God that I know is strong enough. So I'm concerned about what people will think about your power. It's concern for the glory of God's presence. You're with us. And if people think that that's what happens to people that God is with, that he just gets angry one day and just explodes on them and destroys them all, then people are not going to give you the glory that you deserve. So please act in such a way that others would see and would give you the glory because they want to follow you too. They want to be with you. You made promises, God. So be the kind of God who keeps your promises no matter how hard they are to keep. And then, finally, it's this appeal to God for the character that he's proven again and again and again, that he's slow to anger, he's steadfast in love, that he's forgiving, that he's measured in his justice. This is a quotation. God had revealed himself, remember back in Exodus 24 and following, he revealed himself to Moses on the mountain, and it's there that he says, the Lord, the Lord. He says all these things about himself. And Moses internalizes that and turns it around. He'd been meditating on God's character. He says, God, this is the God that you are. Please act accordingly. This is a good prayer, by the way. Just talking to God about who he is. Moses is going to walk away assured of God's action. And do you think God's going to want to respond to a prayer like this? He does. So God is going to be patient. In verse 20, I have pardoned according to your word, but there are going to be some consequences. And what's the consequence that comes? They're not going to get to go in. Except for, of course, verse 24, Caleb. Now, this is a really cool study. I would encourage you sometime, just do a word search on Caleb. And look at all the things that are said about Caleb. Caleb is a cool guy. I love what's said about him later in Joshua. Just the way he interacts with Joshua. Joshua and Caleb are these kind of, you know, these buddies, these peers. I won't get into it. But just, like, do some word study on Caleb and just look at him. But verse 24, he has a different spirit. There's something inside him that's different than the rest of the crowd. What is it? Well, he's followed me fully. I will bring him into the land into which he went, and his descendants shall possess it. But the rest of the people, because they said their little ones wouldn't go in, they couldn't go in, well, the little ones are going to go in, but they're going to die in the wilderness. Verse 28, as I live, declares the Lord, what you have said in my hearing, I will do to you. Your dead body shall fall in this wilderness. And of all your number, listed in the census from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me, not one shall come into the land where I swore that I would make you dwell, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. But your little ones, who you said would become a prey, I will bring in, and they shall know the land that you have rejected. Now, the people are pretty upset by this. Don't lead us in. Don't take us there. Let's go back to Egypt. And God says, okay, fine. I'm not going to lead you there. You're going to stay out here and die. They decide to do what? No. We can go in. We can go in. And they all get ready to go to battle. And they're going to go into battle. Moses says, don't go into battle. They go into battle. And what happens? They lose. They get chased out. Lynn?
I have a question. I hope this isn't taking me too far back.
That's right.
When it talks about in verse 4 that they said to one another, let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt, it says in Nehemiah 9 that they did appoint a leader. Like, they stiffened their neck and appointed a leader to return to their slavery in Egypt.
Mm.
And so I'm just curious about, like, there's especially the focus on them grumbling and speaking against the Lord, is there a reason why that's really emphasized, where it seems like they're actually doing something about it too, but what's really focused on here is the idea of them speaking?
I don't know that there's going to be so much of a difference. These are all just stages that are expressed from the same heart, right? They're grumbling. They're speaking against Moses. They're pointing a new leader. I hadn't seen the Nehemiah 9 reference. It's helpful. And they're picking up stones to destroy Moses and Aaron. These are all just different stages. You know, he punishes Miriam and Aaron just for speaking, and now these people are doing. I don't know that I've got more to say on that. It's good insight. People can be defeated in battle, and they're going to have to come back. It's sort of, I don't know, there's all sorts of applications. The point is this. When God tells us to do something, that's the thing that we do. God says, go into the land. They say, no. God says, okay, fine, don't go into the land. They say, no, we'll go into the land. You got to follow God, whatever he says to do. It may seem different from day to day. You've got to follow God. And the principles he lays out and the instructions that he tells us to do, it's because he spoke them that we do them. All right, we've got to stop there. We'll take about a 10-minute break. We'll pick up in Numbers 15, Lord willing, next Sunday. Thanks, everybody.